There we go. Okay, I'm going to. All right, for the record, it's November 30th, 2023, 9 o'clock a.m. I'm Phil Albrecht, a hearing examiner for Kitsap County. We have the Silverview Apartment SEPA and Conditional Use Permit Appeals, files numbers 2300913 and 23-02979. We're on day three. Mr. Bricklin is nearing the end of the appellant's presentation. I think he's got one or two witnesses left. So unless there are any other preliminary matters, I think we can jump right back into it. Mr. Bricklin, who's your next witness?
Maybe two preliminary matters. One on the, you said your transcription software is not operating, or did it?
Oh, it's yeah, it's back on. Yeah, yeah, oh, okay, it's great. Working.
So I was going to say that's very useful for
Oh,
anybody.
Good. Glad to hear it. Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to give you time to make yeah. that happen if you needed a second. The other thing is you had mentioned talking this morning about day four.
Right.
I don't know
yeah.
That
yeah.
Now or later.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that now. That's a good idea.
I
get
don't
that
care.
Done.
Just,
yeah. Yeah. Let's take care of it. Yeah. That sounds good. Like I said, my first available day is next Wednesday. Is that something that works for you, Mr. Bricklin, or do we need to wait later?
Next Wednesday is the 6th.
Yes.
Yeah, that's actually it's an okay day for me. Ms. Clungeon, how's that work for you?
That
and
could...
I see one of our witnesses is not available that day.
I believe it might be two. In my calendar, but...
I thought it was Bill is not available that day.
I also have Rod as not available then as well. But I don't know if you have updated information on that.
Oh, right. Yeah, because I was reading his... I thought he gave us unavailable dates. He gave me available dates, right? Yeah, so we have two witnesses who are not available on Wednesday.
Okay.
The county also has at least one.
Oh, witness. That's not available? Okay. How about...
Sorry, the 6th through the 8th, actually, one of the county witnesses is out, so.
Oh, okay, so we're talking about the next week then, like December 11th, Monday? That's open for me. How about that, Mr. Bricklin?
So the problem then is you start getting into holiday schedules. Dr. Cook is gone, starting the 11th, Matthew is also gone. Starting the 11th, both of them through Christmas and even a few days beyond for one of them. So it gets very messy at that point, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And then other people have individual days that they're not available in that time. But we have two witnesses who are just gone for the holidays at that point.
I mean, can Mr. Lynn present his witnesses on the 6th without the witnesses you're talking about being present to monitor what's going on, or?
Yes, I think so. We could, you know, especially with the transcripts that are being created, you know, we can get those to our witnesses to read it. It's not perfect for me. You know, I get some assistance from the witnesses in for cross-examination, but I don't know that I can hold up the hearing on that basis.
Okay. Mr. Lynn, what about the 6th? Can you present your witnesses on the 6th? I mean, you know, also considering you'll have some time today, hopefully, to do that as well.
We do have some availability problems on the 6th, and I was going to ask about the 8th. Is that a day that the examiner and the appellants are available? I understand there's a county witness not available.
Yeah.
I am not available on the 8th.
I am not available either.
Okay.
Maybe we can check during the, as the hearing proceeds this morning. I know that there's at least one witness not available on the 6th. That maybe that we can work around that.
Okay.
Person.
Yeah, it sounds like given the holidays that we may have to like do half days just so that we can, you know, kind of patch it together to fit around everyone's schedule. So, yeah, we'll go that route then. Yeah, Mr. Lynn, if you could check for yourself and then we can work from there. So,
yeah.
All right, Mr. Bricklin, let's move on to your witness then.
Actually, I think Ms. Clungeon's going to have the first one.
Okay. All right, Ms. Clungeon.
Yes, I believe we're going to have Maynard Maland, JJ. Is he in the waiting room?
Okay, Ms. Walston will bring him up.
Not unless he's listed. I don't see anything under Maynard or JJ. Or anything that looks close to that at the moment.
Okay, well, let me just take a look at the attendees. I do not see him. It looks like he might be having some issues logging on, so apologies. I'll give him a call, and I don't know if we can...
Yeah, let's take a 5 well, we'll take, yeah, 5-minute break. We'll be back on at 9:10.
Okay. Thank you.
Recording stopped.
All right, is Clenchett any luck?
No, so I think might.
Yeah, so we'll switch. We're gonna, we're not sure what happened there. So we'll start with our other witness who we were expecting this morning, Rod Malcolm.
Okay. Let Ms. Walston get him up on the panel.
Yep, on his way over. Yeah. Should be connecting in just a second.
Okay. There he is. Okay, Mr. Malcolm, welcome to the Zoom panel. Just need to unmute yourself there so I can swear you in. Great. Okay, just raise your right hand. Do you swear, affirm, tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding? Okay, great. Okay, go ahead, Ms. Clungeon.
It'll be my witness.
Oh, all right.
Good morning, Mr. Malcolm. Welcome. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
All right. Could you tell the hearing examiner a little bit about yourself, who you work for, what you do, and your background and experience?
I'm Roderick Malcolm. I have a bachelor's degree in biology from Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. On top of that, I have a post-baccalaureate diploma in environmental toxicology, which is the equivalent of a professional master's degree. I'm currently an ecologist, biologist, and employee of the Squamish Indian, the Natural Resources Department of the Squamish Indian Tribe of Port Madison Reservation, and I've been in that position September of last year. My duties are to review environmental documents, permit applications, etc., with particular attention to the impacts to salmon and their habitats. Prior to working for the Suquamish tribe, I spent a year and a half working for the Lower Nicola Indian Band in British Columbia, where I did similar work. And prior to that, I worked for the Fisheries Department of the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe, where I spent 10 years doing solely environmental review, and another 15 years where a fair proportion of the work was environmental review.
And what is your familiarity with this Silverview project that's before us today?
I first became involved with the project in February of this year when the revised MD&S was issued, and I reviewed many of the project application materials at that time, such as the summary responses to the ACUP denial hearing, the storm drainage reports, the geotechnical reports, the CEPA checklist, the wetland technical memorandums, and the hydrology report. After that, I also reviewed the ecology's letter of 3 December of 2018. I have been to the site once and to the immediate adjacent areas twice in this year so far.
And did you prepare the tribe's comment letter that's Appellant's Exhibit 17 in this matter?
Yes, I did.
So, based on your review and your expertise, have you developed an opinion as to whether the county has adequately, fully described the project's adverse environmental impacts?
Yes, I have.
And what is your opinion?
That the impacts the water quality and groundwater quantity have not been adequately described.
All right. And does that include pollution impacts when you as well?
Yes, it does.
I guess that's the water quality part of it. And can you elaborate on that more specifically? What's your thinking as to why those impacts have not been adequately addressed?
The pollution impacts resulting from the project's drainage to the southwest corner have not been adequately addressed. This location is approximately 400 feet away from Dye's Inlet, and that portion of Dye's Inlet is an embayment mostly separated from the remainder of Dye's Inlet by a spit and connected by a narrow channel. Page 3 of Appellant 17 shows a spit and how narrow the channel is. This embayment or lagoon is a pocket estuary. And pocket estuaries have outmigrant Chinook fry densities typically greater than in adjacent nearshore areas. So it's an important area and expected to be used by large numbers of outmigrating Chinook salmon. And this embayment is actually the logical scale for considering some of the impacts of the project, such as changes to freshwater input, rather than Dye's Inlet as a whole.
Explain that to me. What do you mean the appropriate scale? You still there? I lost you.
I'm still here.
Okay.
The broader the geographical area that one looks at, the ascertain an impact, generally the less the impact is because it's diluted through all the, and then one also starts to consider other impacts from adjacent development rather than focusing on the on the impacts of the development in hand. To give you an example, Dye's Inlet is very wide. And groundwater recharge from the project site in the Dye's Inlet is very small. If you're looking at total groundwater input in the Dye's Inlet, if one looks at the groundwater input into the embayment just near the project site, the project site most likely represents a very high proportion of the groundwater, freshwater groundwater input into that lagoon or embayment. And that's why scale is important.
And I guess we're using multiple terms to describe that feature, embayment, lagoon, estuary, all referring to the same spot, if you will.
I'm using a lagoon and embayment refer to the same spot.
All right.
Estuary is can be a physical term as well as a water description of a type of water based upon its salinity patterns. I'm going to try and avoid using the term estuary as a whole. So basically,
all right, I'll
reduce the potential that I'm talking about impacts to Dye's Inlet as a whole versus impacts to the lagoon or the embayment.
All right, I'll refer to it as either the lagoon or embayment then. And is that lagoon or embayment, is that a particularly important environmental resource within Dye's Inlet as a whole?
Yes, for a couple of reasons. It's approximately 2,400 feet away from the mouth of Clear Creek, which supports populations of Chinook salmon, chum, coho, steelhead. And of those species, Chinook and chum are particularly dependent upon shallow water habitat in their early rearing phase in the estuary. They remain in the upper parts of the water column, and they move in and out with the tides, feeding on organisms. They are not found, Chinook and chum are not found any great distance away from the shoreline during the early part of their estuarine rearing. And Dye's Inlet, the lagoon, the embayment is protected by the spit, has relatively gentle water conditions. And that's where the literature shows large numbers of Chinook fry tend to spend time as they're moving through the marine waters.
And is that, does that also provide important habitat?
Provide some important habitats for the invertebrate organisms that they prey upon, and a host of other wildlife will use it, but it's particularly important the juvenile Chinook salmon.
Okay. Do juvenile salmon feed on sand lance?
Typically the ones that would be in Dye's Inlet at the time, or in the embankment, in the embayment at the time, but not the too small. But as they get larger and move further offshore, they would.
Okay. And does that embayment provide habitat for sand lance that those salmon eventually prey on?
Yes. The spit is mapped as, by the State Department of Fish and Wildlife as sand lance spawning habitat. And one of the features associated with sand lance spawning habitat is freshwater upwelling places.
So the examiner's already heard something about this extremely lethal pollutant associated with runoff from parking lots called 6-PPD-Q or 6-PPD-quinone. Are you familiar with that pollutant?
Yes, I am.
All right. You want to, from your perspective, again, the examiner's heard some of this already, but can you briefly explain with your ecology background, what that pollutant is and why it is getting so much attention these days?
It's been known for a couple decades that urban runoff, stormwater runoff, has been lethal to coho salmon. And so a lot of effort was spent trying to identify what in it was causing the lethality. And it was around 2020 that 6 PPD, and it's a degradation product, 6 PPD Q or 6 PPD quinone, was identified as the toxic chemical in urban runoff. It's used, 6 PPD is used in tires to reduce ozonation and prevent cracking. It's its transformation product, 6 PPDQ, that's highly toxic to coho salmon. And by toxic, I mean lethal. Put it in context, 5 drops of PPDQ in an Olympic-sized swimming pool is a dosage, creates a dosage that will kill 50% of the coho salmon exposed to it.
5 drops?
5 drops, yeah.
Like from a little dropper?
Yes.
Okay.
It's toxic at 0.5 parts per billion.
And does it affect Chinook too?
This is where it gets interesting. It's lethal to coho at much lower concentrations as it is lethal to Chinook. Most
you mean
of
the other way around?
It's much more lethal to coho than it is to Chinook.
Yes.
But that a lack of lethality does not mean it's not toxic. Most of the studies to date have focused on lethality. There's now studies starting to be published in the peer-reviewed literature looking at sublethal effects. And those include things such as reduced length of hatching, smaller eyes, and so while it may not be as lethal to Chinook as it is to coho, it is still has some impact on them.
Okay.
And how those play out over the life history trajectory has not yet been determined.
And are you aware that one of the parking lots at this proposed project would drain into a series of stormwater conveyances and into the discharge into the lagoon?
Yes.
Did, in your review of the county's environmental review documents, did you see any assessment by the county of the impacts of that discharge from that parking lot into the lagoon? Is there any analysis of the water quality impacts of that?
In the documents I reviewed, I saw no such analysis.
Any discussion at all about the impacts of 6 PPDQ?
I did not see any discussion of that.
And is that true both with regard to the discharge pathway that goes from the southwest corner to the lagoon, as well as the discharge pathway that goes off in the other direction and eventually reaches Clear Creek? True that no analysis of the 6 PVD impacts for either of those pathways?
I did not see any analysis for either of those pathways.
Without that information, could the county adequately assess the project's environmental impacts?
No.
And let's talk a bit. Some of the questioning yesterday from lawyers for the other parties focused on the absence of anything in the ecology manual that was adopted back in 2019, prescribing certain methods for treating stormwater. First of all, I gather, given what you just said, that 6 PPDQ wasn't isolated as the contaminant of concern until 2020, not surprising that the 2019 manual doesn't address it directly, is that right?
That is correct.
but more recently has Ecology published a document outlining treatment best management practices for tire contaminants, including 6-PPDD?
Yes, they did in June of 2022. They published a document called Stormwater Treatment of Tire Contaminants, Best Management Practices Effectiveness. And it looked at a series of best management practices and rated them from low to high as to what they thought might work, as well as a list of unknowns that could affect the efficacy of what they were of these measures.
And what were the measures that Ecology has identified as potential means to address this pollutant?
Measures such as reducing the amount available for conveyance to surface water, such as increased levels of street sweeping, cleaning out of drainage ditches, and parking areas, as well as
sweeping the parking lots as well?
Yes. And biofiltration through various media.
What does biofiltration mean?
Oh, it's basically soil, vegetation, various materials which the water runs through, and then the natural processes of the bacteria, the vegetation themselves remove the contaminants or attempt or perceive to remove the contaminants.
You've indicated that your background experience, you've dealt a lot with SEPA implementation, is that right?
Yes.
As somebody who's either created SEPA documents or reviewed them, would you limit yourself to pollutants that happen to be addressed in the 2019 manual, or do you view SEPA's environmental review scope to be broader than that?
I'm just going to object just to note that this calls for a legal conclusion. The witness can testify about his experience, but not about whether that's consistent with SEPA.
That's fine. I'm just asking for his experience.
Okay. Yeah, overall, to the extent it's based on his experience working with SEPA.
In my experience, I have seen SEPA used to address issues that are not explicitly listed in code.
Okay. Is there a term that you use to refer to that when SEPA addresses issues that aren't already addressed in the code?
Substantive SEPA authority, gap filler.
Gap filler, okay. And when you stated earlier that it was your opinion that the county's environmental review was not adequate because it hadn't addressed 6-PPDQ, that was taking into account that 6-PPDQ is not yet included in the stormwater manual. Is that right?
Yes.
And in fact, because it's not addressed in the manuals, that actually increase the importance of addressing it in the SEPA process?
I would believe so.
All right. What information do you think the county should have included in its SEPA analysis of this issue?
How much water was actually going to be surface water would be leaving the site post-development versus pre-development, total volume, plus what was going to go through each of the two discharge points, the total catchment area of impervious surfaces that could trap 6-PPDQ, and an estimate of loadings that could be discharged, leave the site and enter the two water bodies. And then a more detailed look at the two discharge points as they enter Clear Creek and Dyes Inlet, and the extent to which they may congregate salmon and therefore make them more vulnerable to the discharge, because the discharge points might be areas where salmon tend to hang out. I would point out that once coho salmon start to show symptoms of 6 ppd dew poisoning, even if removed to fresh water, they die. So showing the symptoms indicates they will die. So
not reversible.
In the literature I've come across, there's only been one reference to one salmon surviving, and it was regarded as atypical. So
basically, an adequate environmental review would assess, approximate the amount of these pollutants that would be discharged into Clear Creek and into the lagoon, and assess the populations of salmon that would be in the near those discharge points and potentially impacted. Is that kind of the nuts and bolts of it?
Yes.
All right. So in addition to these pollution impacts, are there, I think you mentioned at the outset, there were also water quantity impacts that haven't been adequately addressed. What are those?
Well, the project's going to create impervious surfaces. Water cannot infiltrate through the impervious surfaces. Typically, some of the water on the impervious surfaces runs off the site and is not available for infiltration. Given that this is close to near shore, there's water upwelling into the embayment in the adjacent areas, and that provides important habitat features. I feel that there's a potential for the project to alter the inflow of groundwater into the embayment in the adjacent areas, and the potential scale needs to be quantified, such as it's not unreasonable to have the applicant quantify the total amount of water that runs off the site prior to development, the total amount of water that will leave the site following development, and the difference between the two is potentially a reduction in water available for infiltration on the site. That information should be readily available from the appendixes in the stormwater report. It's just stormwater analysts don't look it that way. They look at peak flows and peak volumes rather than total volumes. So.
And then Dr. Cook also mentioned not just total volumes, but also how that's spread out through the seasons and through the year.
Yes. The hydro period, it's the stormwater manual goes into great detail about how to protect wetland hydro periods. It doesn't go into that detail over groundwater. The other thing that can happen is on an undeveloped site, given certain assumptions and generalities, the rainfall infiltrates across most of the site. It is potentially possible that you could have the same volume of water being infiltrated into a site, but if you change the point of location where it's infiltrated, you can change the points of upwelling in the nearby adjacent areas.
Ms. Clinton, I'm sorry I didn't give you any advance notice on this, but could you pull up Mr. Matthews' gradient map, you know, that showed the site and the neighboring areas to the south towards the lagoon? Can you pull that up? And I'm going to ask.
Yes.
Using that.
I think, hold on, let me make sure I get the right spot here. Are you talking about this?
Hold on, look. Yes, that would be great.
Yeah, what's okay, the exhibit number?
That's exhibit 8 and page 6.
I am so impressed with your ability to do that so quickly. I would be 12 minutes from now before I got that. Mr. Malcolm, can you see that exhibit on your screen there?
Yes, I can.
And by any chance, were you listening in when Mr. Matthew testified about this the other day?
Yes, I was.
Oh, great. All right. Well, then, so I'll just, as I understand what he said, and correct me if I got this wrong, but basically, groundwater in the that's moving through the subject property to the southwest would continue in the pre-development state, would continue moving to the southwest towards and eventually reaching the lagoon, roughly within the pathway defined by those magenta lines on the left and the right. Is that what you understood his testimony to be?
Yes.
All right. And then I also heard yesterday Mr. Leiter point out that the buildings that are going to be arranged here on a diagonal, basically perpendicular to that groundwater flow across much of the property, that their foundations would go down 11 or maybe even 13 feet and essentially act as dams and would capture a lot of that shallow groundwater flow and put it into pipes as the result of some footing drains that would discharge ultimately into the lagoon. But I'm wondering, to the extent that water in the pre-development state is, if you will, trickling through there as groundwater versus collecting it and discharging it as a pipe, what are the kinds of impacts that would have in terms of fresh water recharging of the lagoon? Does that change the time? I guess what I'm getting at, does that change the timing of the water recharging, the fresh water recharging the lagoon?
It can change the timing. Also, it can change the same amount of fresh water into the lagoon, depending how it comes in time or space, can produce different habitats. Water coming from a point source will tend to have a certain habitat around the point source, but if that same volume of water is coming in as a narrow band along the shoreline, that's going to potentially have the same plant and insect community, but it's going to be distributed differently in space. You have a band along the shoreline versus an area around the discharge pipe. So.
Was there any evaluation of that, those kinds of impacts in the county's environmental review documents?
I did not see any.
And the county lawyer asking Mr. Leiter questions yesterday afternoon suggested, well, maybe not all the water would be intercepted by the drains. And he said, you know, wouldn't some of it get pushed off at the ends, you know, kind of hit the wall and then push off to the side. Would that also change the flow regime of the water reaching the lagoon?
Getting into hydrology details, which is beyond my expertise.
All right, let me ask you another question then. What did you see any analysis of that, you know, of the lawyer's conjecture about how the groundwater might respond to hitting that wall? Was there any analysis of that in the county's environmental review documents?
No.
And by the way, when you spoke of a moment ago, when you said there's a difference in that species that would respond to that freshwater input to the lagoon, and you know, locationally, and you said, you know, if it's coming out of a pipe, there would be a certain area around that pipe end where that where those plants or animals would thrive, versus if it's coming through the ground, there's going to be a band where that would be. Would that be when you said a band? Are you talking about a strip along the beach where the groundwater is exiting and entering into the exiting the ground and entering into the lagoon?
It could be the beach. It could be a subtitle. It would depend where it's actually entering the lagoon. And then the plants and the species would adapt to their salinity tolerances and populate where it's suitable for them.
And in addition to the impacts to salmon, are there other resources in the lagoon and the embayment that would be at risk of impact from this project?
Well, there's sand lance spawning on the right. spit. And then their larvae will be used in the lagoon for a little while. When I was doing a site visit several months ago for another project, I saw a very cute crab walking around in the intertidal. So there's birds, there's a fair amount of invertebrates in the area.
And is there an oyster restoration project?
Yes, there is a Puget Sound Restoration Fund is proposing an oyster restoration project in the lagoon and just outside the lagoon. They regard this as one of the most suitable sites for oyster restoration in Puget Sound. And the core permit was issued this year, and the county staff were aware of this restoration project, as I pointed it out during the comment letter to the revised SEPA MD&S.
So regarding the water quantity and the runoff impacts, just in general, do you have an opinion as to whether the county has adequately addressed those in its environmental review documents?
For water quality, water quantity, they have not addressed that. Stormwater analysis is typically to the manual. It's like studying, it's like teaching to the exam. There's other environmental impacts attributed to stormwater, but they're not addressed because it's not required to address them in order to get a permit.
I think you said at the outset that you've had some personal observations of the site?
Yes.
And I think you said you've been by the site twice and maybe right adjacent to the site once. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
And since you're kind of have the advantage of being an eyewitness observer, could tell the examiner what you observed there when you were present?
On my most recent trip, I was looking at the parcel in question. I walked it from that area there. I did not enter the site. I could not see the interior of the site due to the obscuring vegetation. I noticed the water in the drainage ditch. This road is looking from west to east.
Yeah, what's so this exhibit we're looking at? What's the exhibit number?
This is exhibit 19.
Okay.
Photos from Mr. Malcolm.
Okay, sorry to interrupt, Mr. Malcolm. Go ahead.
Thank you.
I took this picture, this one too. Could you go back to the previous picture, please?
And both are exhibit 19? Yeah, it looks like it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the first one was, page one.
This picture is taken looking east. I'm standing west. The vegetation to the left is to the north, that's the property, and then the relatively open field to the right, that's an adjacent property. On the Silverview property, this location here, I noticed a drainage ditch on the road on the property side. There was water in it. The water was flowing, and the soils were also wet several inches above the water level in the drainage ditch. I also noticed what appeared to be remnant swales on the adjacent property to the south. particularly in the areas where one can see the trees and vegetation grow.
Down there, down the road, maybe 50 or 100 yards.
Yep. Yes. This is roughly the same location. I am.
Wait. Before you go on, could you go back to that prior one? So, is that area on the left-hand side of the picture that's the southwest corner of the subject property? Is that right?
Not exactly the southwest corner. I'm not standing at the intersection.
I see. How far to the east of that intersection are you, roughly? If you remember.
I would say no more than 100 feet.
All right. And I don't know if you were present. Dr. Cook referenced a thick blackberry patch in the southwest corner. Are those blackberries there on the left-hand side of this picture?
Some of them are, some of them are not. So.
All right. Does that patch extend back behind you, back towards the intersection?
Yes.
All right, then go on, thank you.
Okay, next picture, please. This was taken from the intersection of the gravel road shown in the previous picture, looking to the north, towards Brooklyn Road. One can see blackberries here, and again, more of the obscuring vegetation. There's also a drainage ditch here. This would be roughly the southwest corner of the property.
Okay.
And there was some water flow in this ditch.
So the ditch, I'm not able to make out the ditch, but Basically it's right on the... Can you describe where it is?
If one looks down to the bottom of the screen, one sees 2-2/5.
Yeah.
If one basically goes straight up from that, that would be the approximate position of the ditch.
Okay. Yep. Sort of along the edge of the blackberry bushes?
Slightly into the blackberry bushes, that general area.
Right. All right. You can kind of see it get a little hint of it up near the top of the hill there.
Yeah.
All right, thank you. And next.
This is just taken from the road extending west to east on the southern boundary of the property, just showing the vegetation growing immediately next to the drainage.
Mm-hmm. Again, somewhere in the first 100 feet or so of that road.
Maybe a couple hundred feet down. So.
All right. Okay. And then what's this next picture?
I'm going to have to check my notes for that one because I have two similar pictures.
Okay. Can you do that?
I will do that. That's the drainage ditch on the north side of the road, of the gravel road that separates the subject parcel from the property to the south, and that is showing water in the drainage at the time, and that was taken a couple weeks ago.
And that's Exhibit 19, page 4, is that correct, Ms. Kludgen?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes. And last?
This is kitty corner from the southwest corner of the property site.
So the northeast corner of a parcel, kitty corner is the subject?
It's near that. I'm looking south where water from the southwest corner of the site passes under Mickleberry Road northwest before entering Dyes Inlet.
See.
So Dyes Inlet would be at the upper, very top of the picture.
Got it.
And then this is, the lagoon. This enters the lagoon.
All right.
And this is Exhibit 19, page 5.
Yes.
Yeah,
okay.
And so this is those two drainage ditches that you described that run along the south and west borders of the property. They then go into a culvert under the road and then continue on this path that we're looking at in picture five, page five.
That's what it appeared to be when I was on the graph there.
All right. Give me a second here. Do you have anything more to add, Mr. Malcolm? I think that covers everything that we had in mind.
Well, the extent of impacts associated with the project are going to be based upon the scale of the development at the site. And the scale of the development at the site depends upon the actual size of the wetlands. And that's a point of contention. When this project first came up, a tribal representative was on a site visit and concluded that the wetlands are much larger than what the applicant's documents show. And the tribe maintains that position to this day, that the wetlands are considerably larger than the applicant's delineation is given. And this needs to be resolved.
And let me ask you about that then. The examiner in 2020 directed that a new delineation be prepared of the wetland in the middle of the property. In your review of the file, did you see a new delineation prepared subsequent to 2020?
I could not find one. I could just find documents referring to the older delineation and back and forth to what things meant.
All right. I have nothing further for this witness. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brickland. All right, Mr. Lynn, you're next.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
I represent the applicant. I guess you're aware of that since you've been participating or listening in. Let me just ask a question about that wetland topic. You weren't present during any of the site visits by the tribe that were discussed in the earlier hearing.
That is correct.
And you're not a hydrologist?
That is correct.
And you're not a civil engineer?
That is correct.
You talked about the size of the estuary. Do you know the size of the area that contributes either surface or groundwater to the estuary?
Are you referring to the, just so I'll make sure I'm answering your question, are you referring to the embayment / ragoon or Dyes Inlet as a whole?
I'm sorry, I'll try to follow Mr. Brickland's lead and talk about well, you tell me the terminology I should use to reference the lagoon. Is it just lagoon?
Lagoon or embayment, either will work with me. So.
So do you know what the area is that contributes surface or storm water to the lagoon?
Yes.
And how big is it relative to the size of this subject property?
I came across a document that said the basin area was 0.17 square miles, at least 1.17 square miles. I rounded it up to 0.2 square miles. The project site's approximately 5.3 acres, so assuming the surface catchment area is 2.2 square miles, the project site represents 4.1% of the total surface basin area, much of which has already been developed by impervious surfaces. So the pervious surfaces at the site represent a much higher percentage of the total remaining pervious surface areas in the approximately 1.7 to 0.2 square mile surface catchment area.
I'm sorry. So it's about 4% of the total catchment area, but because some of it is developed, it represents a higher percentage of the, and did you say developed or undeveloped area?
Of the undeveloped areas.
Okay. So, you've characterized the good qualities and the good habitat of the lagoon, and that's, you stand by that, correct?
Yes.
So despite the development that's occurred and the impervious surfaces in this large area that contributes water, the site remains thriving with respect to its habitat and environmental benefits. Is that fair to say?
I would not use the term thriving. It's the shoreline has been altered. There's potentially water quality impacts, but it remains a valuable habitat.
And that's despite the fact that there are both roads and parking lots within the developed area of the basin?
Yes.
And much of the area that is within this overall basin is to the east and is low-density residential development.
Is that a question, sir?
Yeah, it was. My voice rose slightly at the end to indicate a question, but I'll try to be more clear about that. Yeah, that was a question.
Okay. I'm not familiar with the overall distribution of zoning or buildings in the area.
Okay. You're not aware that the area to the east of the site is larger lots, residential development?
I'm aware that there's larger lots and that to the immediate north there's a commercial area. I'm aware of that detail, but I can't point to specific neighborhoods and say this is what's there.
Okay. Is it fair to say that whatever development is there has altered the hydrology, the rate and flow and distribution of surface and groundwater?
Yes.
And you're familiar with the manual genuinely, the storm manual, I meant by that?
Yes, I am.
And isn't one of the goals of that to preserve the distribution, the rates and flows of stormwater in the before and after condition with a development?
It's try and preserve the natural discharge point. It does not actually preserve the natural hydro regime. It's
okay.
Physically impossible to do.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. But it does...
Unless all the stormwater is infiltrated.
Okay.
If once you go to discharge, it alters things.
Okay. And that's not possible on this site? Did you read the storm report and understand that?
It's not possible given the scale of the development that's being proposed.
Well, and given the elevations of the groundwater, correct? And if I'm asking a question that's appropriate addressed to a civil engineer, let me know.
You're asking for two specific questions for my expertise.
Okay, fair. I appreciate that. Thank you. So are you aware, and I thought you testified that you did not see a report indicating the current and planned runoff rates from the site. Was that your testimony? Did I misunderstand that?
No, this is, get back to my comment of the teaching to the exam. Stormwater management deals with water runoff, and it deals with basically instantaneous volume and peak volume, because they're trying to avoid eroding the downstream channel. What they generally don't deal with is what's the total volume of water that's going to be leaving the site. And that's what I testified to. It didn't discuss the total amount of water leaving the site prior to development versus the total amount of water leaving the site after development.
So you did not see that in your review of the storm drainage report and other information in the record? Sensitivity of the lagoon. Isn't the lagoon designated by the county as a critical fish and wildlife habitat? And if you don't know, that's fine. Just
yeah, I'm just trying to mull their definition through my mind.
Okay.
And I would say I don't know because I don't want to say yes when I might be wrong.
Okay.
So,
are you familiar with that scheme of regulations generally? Does it attach specific regulations for specific types of critical areas?
Yes, as well as the requirement for a special areas report.
Okay. And are you familiar with the shoreline designation of the property, with the shoreline master program also containing specific regulations for the protection of those resources that are identified?
I'm not aware of the specific shoreline designation. I have read the county's shoreline master program.
I think you've mentioned untreated stormwater. I don't think you meant to say that the stormwater from the site was untreated, did you? Under the proposal, isn't there treatment proposed as part of the development plan?
Some of the discussion yesterday indicated there would be treatment.
Well, I mean, isn't that required by the manual?
Treatment for water quality?
Yes.
Because some sites do not need to treat for quantity.
Okay.
But yes, once you hit a certain threshold, the area you typically need to treat for quality.
Okay. And did you understand that the proposal is for enhanced treatment, the higher level of treatment contemplated by the manual?
I recall that conversation. I can't recall the specific statements that were made.
So just so I understand the lagoon, and this is just one question on this topic, it's a combination of fresh and salt water, correct? There are tidal influences. There's in addition to the fresh water, there's also salt water?
Yes.
So turning to 6PD, and I'm sorry if I bounce around here a little. I'm following along. So it's not just parking lots that contribute 6 PPD, is it?
That is correct.
And so all of the roads in the basin would also contribute, and all of the other parking lots in the basin would also contribute 6 PPD?
Yes.
The road we saw in the picture, Mickleberry, that's another road traveled by the neighbors. That presumably is a street that would also produce 6 PPD.
Yes.
It is one way to reduce 6 PPD impacts that kind of is better than treatment, the use of transit. Would a project that encourages and depends on the use of transit be a good way to help reduce PPD?
I lack sufficient information about the density of 6 PPD in transit tires and how they shed them compared to normal car tires.
Okay.
Answer that question.
But in general, fewer cars on the road would be, or fewer tires on the road would be beneficial, would it not?
Tires come in various sizes. So
okay. You can't say. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Okay. What about walking? Walking doesn't produce PPD, does it?
I would imagine.
Okay. So if you have people housed in close proximity to the places they work, the goal of a walkable community, wouldn't that be another way to reduce PPD?
Yes.
Out of curiosity, this emerging science on 6PPD, has the tribe engaged those methods in its own projects? Does your casino, for example, have mitigation for 6 PPD?
I'm not in that department of the tribe, so I can't, unable to answer that.
Do you know of any example where the tribe has employed 6 PPD mitigation measures in the last couple of years?
I am not personally aware of anything because it's outside of the work that I do for the tribe.
Can you point the examiner to a project of comparable scale that does adequately study PPD in your estimation in the last few years? Another residential project, for example?
I'm not able to do that. This issue's a recent issue.
Okay, thank you. Are this, we saw some kind of residential drainage areas where people had, you know, created a ditch or swale or something. Is the flow of effluent a concern for you with respect to the health of the lagoon from septic systems?
For failing septic systems, yes.
Okay. Even from operated septic systems, are they perfect in terms of preserving water quality?
They're not perfect, but they help preserve water quantity.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Okay, Mr. Gekas.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Malcolm.
Good morning.
Come on. Any questions? Did you read the SEPA checklist in this case?
I have read at least two versions of them.
And then did you make comments, timely comments, within the SEPA comment period on that?
I made comments. I'd have to check my records to see if they were in the noted comment period.
Well, in your comments, do you recall if you mentioned 6 PPD?
I did not mention those.
Do you know if anyone made comments on the SEPA, timely comments on mentioning 6 PPD?
I don't know. One of the reasons I don't know is the county website for the permits often does not include all documents submitted, so I can't review what other people have submitted.
Do you know how long 6 PPD has been in tires?
Decades.
Since the 60s?
I don't know when it first started being used.
Okay. Do you have any idea, those numbers you're giving were pretty large in terms of impacts on salmon, and we hear many different impacts on salmon from everything from dams to disease from fish farms and fish pens spreading, from overfishing, from logging, and the list goes on. Do you know how some of those impacts compare versus the impacts on from 6 PPD? Oh, that's a long question.
They all basically result in reduced fish populations, but 6 PPDQ is one of the most known toxic substance, coho salmon, and it's urban runoff. Some urban streams can have sufficient quantities of 6 PPDQ in them, will result in high mortality rates of coho. You can have perfect habitat, but if you've got that chemical in the ground, you can kill, in the water, you can kill the fish. Dams don't kill all the fish. Forestry doesn't kill all the fish.
Okay. I don't have anything further for you.
Okay. Mr. Malcolm, I had just a couple quick questions before we get back to Mr. Bricklin. And as always, when I ask questions, if the opposing attorneys want to do some recross, you know, based on that new information, that's fine. You know, this is the first time I've dealt with PPD testimony. I've had a lot of hearings with issues concerning PFAS. You're probably familiar with that,
yeah.
And it's kind of similar in PPD, yeah. In that DOE is catching up to figuring out how to treat it. And the defense I usually hear on PFAS is that there's no technology to treat stormwater for PFAS yet, that they're getting there.
Yeah.
And so it's unreasonable to require a developer to mitigate something when there's no technology to do so. Is that, I mean, where's the technology on treating stormwater for PPD?
Some biofiltration works in the lab. When they've done lab experiments, there is a concern, as noted in, I'll just find that exact wording here for you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the Ecology 22 manual, a document I referred to earlier.
they include the statement, no field testing has been performed to confirm the contaminants will remain adhered when water from later storms flows through soil or organic material. So there are some concern that the lab tests will not upscale to the field when they have a lot more stormwater coming through them. The ecology manual, or not the manual, the 2022 document rates low, medium, and high ways of dealing with it. And the highest way is basically source control. Keep it out of the water. Keep it out of the water.
Oh, I see. Now, how would you do that, though?
Oh, increased frequency of street sweeping to get the particles up.
Mm-hmm.
Cleaning out the ditches. I guess to remove the entrapped material. And then biofiltration. But biofiltration is one they're not sure if it's going to upscale to the real world. As a follow-on, if I may, Your Honor, one of the problems with is science evolves and they attempt to retrofit stormwater features or stormwater facilities. The land is not available to do that because the site has been built out.
Mm-hmm.
When a residence in a rural area is going in, part of the site plan is typically a reserve septic field in case there's a problem with the original septic site. I think it would be reasonable that in the absence of ecology guidance at this time, just set aside additional land on the site for expanded stormwater facilities in the future that deal with 6 PPDQ as guidance from ecology is coming. And if ecology rules that land, that current technologies actually work, that land can remain an open space.
Okay.
For the project.
Yeah, and that kind of relates to what my next question was going to be. If I were to say, you know, we have to put in these biofiltration facilities, would that result in a radical redesign of the whole stormwater system? I mean, are you dealing then with, different impacts in terms of off-water flows and that kind of thing?
I'm not a stormwater design
engineer,
so I can't answer that. I just think it would be useful. Most projects now come up with open space requirements, too, is dedicate as part of the project conditions that some of that open space might be made available for additional stormwater facilities.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Malcolm. Any sure. Recross from the attorneys before we get back to Mr. Brickland, given my questions?
Not for me.
Okay, Mr. Lynn?
I said no.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I didn't hear that. Didn't get through. Okay, great. All right. Mr. Brickland?
So I don't see Mr. Brickland on here anymore, unless he's the caller. We had a phone call.
Oh.
Caller join. Ms. Clungeon, if you're there, do you happen to know? I guess I can also just
unmute
and ask.
I can check. 1 second. I believe that is his phone number.
All right, let's see here.
From what I can see, I can't see all of it, but that looks like it. But I can also, hold on 1 second, let me call him directly.
Okay.
All right, here I am.
Oh, there he is.
Okay, so that is you. All right, great.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, my internet went down, so I called back in. I missed some of the cross-examination as a result, but I heard the beginning and the end. I just have the examiner covered one of the issues I was going to cover, so I don't have a lot here. Malcolm, you were asked some questions about whether walking or transit would impact or generate PPD or things like that. Let me ask you this. Let me kind of come at it this way. You already testified that the county did not look at the 6 PPD impacts generated from the parking lot, right?
Yes.
All right. The fact that walking doesn't create 6 PPD, would that change your testimony that you need to take a look at what does create 6 PPD, that is the parking lot source? Or if that was confusing, I can reword it.
You know, parking lots don't create PPDQ. They collect it. It rains down on them. It's the tires and other chemicals, right, that create the 6 PPDQ. So.
Right. So let me try it again. Does the fact that the county needs to analyze the parking lots as a source of 6 PPD, does that, the need for that reduced or eliminated because people who walk don't create 6 PPD?
I don't think eliminates the need for the analysis.
Okay. And likewise, the fact that buses might or might not create 6 PPD, does that change the need for analyzing the parking lots as a source?
Well, bus tires will create the 6 PPDQ.
Whether they do or they don't, whether the buses do or don't create it, does that impact the need to analyze the parking lot source?
I believe it does not impact the need.
The fact that people have septic systems in the area, does that change the need to analyze the parking lot as a source of 6 PPD?
No, does not change the need.
And the fact that there's been other development in this drainage basin that leads down to the lagoon, the baseline pollution, if you will, does that impact the need to analyze the parking lot as a source of 6 PPD?
No, it does not change the need, and we don't know where the tipping point is for cumulative impacts. The lagoon... Go ahead.
Yeah,
sir.
Explain what you mean by that, because that was going to be my next question.
An impact by itself may not be significant, but multiple impacts of the same may become significant. Dyes Inlet has developed, Clear Creek has developed in many areas. The area around the embayment / lagoon is developed in some places. We still have salmon using it. That doesn't mean that the system is functioning well. We just know that it is producing salmon and other biotic resources, and we don't know how much impact it can take. We really need to take a proactive approach to things and ensure we have a lot of information before we move ahead. And allowing one more development to go ahead because the previous development was authorized is just leads to more cumulative effects, and eventually everything will be paved over.
And did the county evaluate that the cumulative effects of the 6 PPD and other stormwater pollutants and the changes in the water quantity reaching the lagoon in this environmental analysis?
Could you repeat the question, please, sir?
Yes. Your testimony, I think, was that in evaluating the impacts of 6 PPD and the impacts of the changes in the water quantity reaching the lagoon, you need to take into account the baseline condition, which includes adverse impacts that are already occurring. Is that correct?
Yes.
That's the cumulative analysis that you're talking about?
Yes.
Taking account of both the existing impacts and the new impacts layered on top of those?
That is correct.
And then last, when we were at the very beginning, you were asked some questions about the subject area size in relation to the entire catchment area. and both as the gross percentage, and then all, you mentioned that there would be a different calculation if you looked at it in terms of undeveloped land in the catchment area. But is that data point, that is, you know, the size of this subject property relative to the entire catchment area, I guess I'm thinking that that's useful if you're thinking about how changes to the subject property might relate to the catchment areas as a whole. But earlier you testified about the impact on water quantity caused by those the damming effect of those buildings, and that intercepts the water that's coming from up gradient. Did I understand that right?
I did not testify to the damming effects. That was Mr. Lither from yesterday.
Right. But you testified today. But you testified today about how that would impact the, assuming there is a damming effect per Mr. Leiter's testimony, you testified as to how that would affect or could affect the lagoon, and that that was an issue that the county hadn't examined. Do I have that right?
I think it's an issue that needs to be examined, yes.
Right. And I guess the point I'm trying to get to there is, to the extent that that is an issue, that's not a function of whether the subject property is 4% of the total catchment area, but rather because this is an impact that is that stems from or adversely affects the entire catchment area, right? I mean, we're talking about water up gradient in this catchment area coming onto the subject property and then being diverted from its normal course, right?
It would affect a portion. It would affect a portion of the upland catchment area. Yes.
Right.
The numbers I threw out were for the surface catchment area, which could differ from the subsurface catchment area. So that's why I kept using the word surface catchment. So.
Perfect. Okay. That's a more elegant way of saying what I was trying to say. Thank you. All right. I think that's all I have for this witness. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Malcolm. Appreciate your testimony. Let's see. Let's move on then. Ms. Clenchin, were you able to get your first witness from today?
Yes, I was. And he is in the attendees.
Okay. And we're pretty close to the 90-minute mark. I think, might as well just take our break now until, let's say, 10:40, and then we'll get started then. So we'll see you at that point.
Okay. Thank you.